Thank you very much. I have nothing to disclose formally, but what I want to disclose is I'm not a health economist. This presentation is going to deal with the economics of the health co-benefits of active transport. I'm used to advocating just on the basis of public health. And in the arena that I'm now working in, which is dealing a lot with transportation planners, they appreciate that, but their governance bodies often require sort of the nuts and bolts of cost-benefit analysis. So I was sort of dragged into this. And for the folks who saw the presentation yesterday, or parts of this, it's really in two parts. One, I'm going to talk about a model that predicts the health co-benefits of active transport as a greenhouse gas reduction strategy. And then I'm going to talk about the monetization of that. So it's going to cover some of the ground I covered yesterday, but I'm going to go through that quickly so we can talk more about the economic impact. So I think everyone in the room knows that climate change is the number one public health threat that we face. What they may not know is that California is the 12th largest carbon emitter in the world, and that when you peer into the inventory of where the greenhouse gases are coming from, the transportation sector leads the pack in California. And when you really get granular, it's the single passenger vehicle that is driving this process. So the strategies on reducing greenhouse gas emissions focuses on this phenomenon, and there's lots of strategies for reducing car dependence, and I've listed them there, less trips, mode switching, mass transit, and active transport. And what I mean by that is bicycling and walking, and in conjunction with public transit, because there's a walk link to the entering and leaving the transit system. So there's lots of strategies. Oops. Go back. Whoa. Can I get back to... Everything is advancing, so let's see. Yeah. Oh, the back arrow. Let's see. Okay. There's lots of strategies for reducing them, but which specific ones of them show co-benefits was really part of the work that I did. And to do this, I partnered with the Regional Transportation Planning Agency in the Nine Bay Area County. So we're in San Francisco. There's eight other counties that in this regional effort. Also, the Bay Area Air Quality Management District, which is responsible for the air quality in the region. And I'm from the State Health Department. We also partnered with James Woodcock, who I'll describe some of the groundbreaking research that they did in developing a co-benefits model that was applied to London and New Delhi, but we wanted to apply it in California. So it was really this group of folks who provided the expertise. The model that was developed is called IFIM, which stands for the Integrated Transport and Health Impacts Model. And what it does is it takes a number of different data sources and synthesizes them, but basically models three pathways of injury. You have traffic injuries, you have physical activity, which is where a lot of the co-benefits that we recognize, and air pollution. There's a lot of other things you can model as well, whether noise and other things that have impacts from the transportation sector. So using travel surveys that describe travel behaviors of bicyclists and pedestrians and car drivers and people who take mass transit, and also health surveys that look at the physical activity we do in the non-transport part of our lives, synthesizing that information with injury information that's collected by the police when they investigate traffic collisions in California, and air pollution data from emissions models that government agencies already are doing in California, and actually modeling things like fine particulate matter in the Bay Area airshed. So all this information is synthesized in the model, and what comes out of it is measures of years of life lost and years of living with disability. So the epidemiologists and the crew may recognize this as disability-adjusted life years, which is a very comprehensive way of looking at the burden of disease and illness. So that's the outcome measure. Now, we developed a number of different scenarios looking at different levels of active transport using both forecasting and backcasting. What I'm going to focus on is that scenario right in the red box, which is really an approach of thinking about active transport that optimizes the health co-benefits by having lots of physical activity, but also optimizes the level of greenhouse gas reductions as well. Basically, it's saying, hey, already in the Bay Area, we spend about 22 minutes a day commuting to work. I mean, that's the Bay Area average. So instead of just doing that mostly in cars, why don't we think about substituting active transport for those minutes? So that was, we sort of created a goal, and it coincides, of course, with the Surgeon General's recommendations for about 20 minutes of physical activity per day. So we use this to drive the model. And what we're talking about as far as on a population basis, this translates from a baseline of about 4.4 minutes per person per day in the Bay Area to about 22 minutes a day. So that's what we're talking, that shift in physical activity. As far as distances, we're talking about a half a mile per person per day up to about 3 3/4 miles. So again, we're not running marathons. We're doing things that would fit into the time budget that people are already spending to get to work or other activities. I'm going to give you the results of the model. So this is going to be, you know, the end of part one. But what you see here is a list of chronic diseases and injuries that are related to physical activity. And in the change in disease burden column, you see a range. And that reflects the range of modest scenarios to that very ambitious. So the high end there, a 15% reduction in cardiovascular disease, that represents what we get from this implementation of 22 minutes per person per day. And to give you, you know, for people who can't think in terms of population attributable risk, if you want to know the number of deaths per year, well, we're talking roughly about 1,900 deaths per year just from cardiovascular disease that would be prevented if we'd made that shift. And you can go through the other chronic disease that are prevalent and drive healthcare costs and everything else in this country: diabetes, depression, dementia, breast cancer, colon cancer. And you do see from road traffic injuries an increase, and that's because we're putting more people out there, you know, amidst cars and other things. So there is an increase. So there's a cautionary note, because safety and the perception of safety is the gate by which people will adopt or not adopt active transport. So we had to pay attention to that. Even despite the fact that when you add up all the numbers, you see that the overall benefit overwashes the risks that are increased by traffic injuries. Now, part two is, now I'm going to talk about monetizing this, because I presented this stuff to the regional transportation planners, and they said, this is great, but it doesn't fit into what we're going to do with it. We do cost-benefit analysis. We need to know what the value of this is. So I put on a very different hat of looking how you would monetize this. So I did a literature review and talked to health economists, and they said there's basically two approaches. You have the cost of illness approach, which is you sum up the direct cost of illness, you know, so the treatment modalities and the diagnosis modalities and hospitalizations and the ER visits and all that stuff. And you can also combine that with, you know, lost productivity. So income losses, productivity losses, you can family caregiving, out of pocket. That's one approach. The other approach is this willingness to pay, which is really asking a group of people how much they would contribute to a collective pool to avoid a certain number of cases to avoid. And that also sort of looks at some of the more intangible parts of cost benefit. So it's often, those figures are often much larger than the direct or indirect cost of illness. So then you saw that list of illnesses and conditions that was modeled by IFIM. So I basically did a literature review looking at, you know, what are the cost of illness for those particular conditions. So I got basically national cost estimates from, you know, National Cancer Institute, the American Heart Association. So all these are the respected entities that usually put out an annual report, and then they have a statistical subcommittee that says this is the cost nationally of those things. They often use the MEPS, Medical Expenditure Panel Survey. I don't know how much folks are familiar with that, to do these national estimates, which you can't often get at a even a state level, because the data is considered confidential without special. So because there was no budget for this, I basically took a simple approach of and you'll see the next slide, of taking this information. It came from a number of different years, the inflation adjusted to a common baseline, so I used 2010. I scaled it to the Bay Area population and applied a formula. So basically said, okay, we have the U.S. cost of illness, we're going to inflation adjust it by, you know, the U.S. figures, and then scale it to the Bay Area by multiplying the fraction that the Bay Area is of the whole U.S., and then taking that population attributable fraction that you saw, those percents, and applying it to this overall cost. And I just want to point out that the way a lot of the cost of illness models work, especially in the area of the cost adjusted, the lost productivity part, does take into account the years of productivity loss. And the ITHM model is looking at years of lost life. So from that standpoint, those models are ways of conceptualizing it sort of dovetail. You'd have to argue that the cost of the years of living with disability is highly correlated to the cost of treatment and diagnosis of living with a chronic condition. So that's how I dealt with the cost of illness part. For the willingness to pay, I just looked up what the federal and state agencies were paying for a cost of life. So US EPA values this at about, you know, statistical life is about $7.4 million. Some of the other agencies, I think FDA, you know, says it's about $5 million. Caltrans in California values a life from a traffic injury at about $4.5 million. I mean, so you can use a range of these things. They're all millions of dollars per life lost. So what I did is then I took the cost of illness figures from this ambitious scenario and applied it to all the conditions. You can see them starting with the cancer and the cardiovascular. I also broke it out into the physical activity portion and the air pollution components of that. And you can see the traffic injuries is there too. Because to be intellectually honest, that's going in the other direction. That's increasing the burden. So when you apply these formula to all the different conditions, the bottom line, which is in the lower right-hand side, is $1.4 billion per year. And this is just the Bay Area. Okay? Let me go into the other method of valuing this, which is the willingness to pay. And again, what I did is I looked at the specific causes in terms of how many lives were lost per year. And you can see the range from the different federal agencies. And there are about 2,214 premature deaths. That's from those specific causes. We know that other causes of morbidity and mortality are associated with physical activity as well. So the Woodcock or the ITHM model is actually conservative. There's other causes there. So if you look at all causes of mortality, you come up with a larger number of deaths that would be associated with the lack of physical activity. So using that, you have a larger number of deaths. It doesn't really matter, because when you multiply through by $7.4 million per life, we're talking about somewhere between $11 and $16 billion per year, and that's sort of just a specific list of causes. If you look at all-cause mortality, we're talking up to $22 billion per year. So that's a lot of money. I mean, this is big time, folks, and this is the kind of information that policy makers need to have to factor into decisions. Right now, none of this kind of information is used in the calculus of cost benefit when specific projects or regional planning scenarios are evaluated by these regional planning agencies. So this is going to hopefully become part of the discussion, because if there isn't a number to it, it tends to get either not be discussed at all or be given some kind of qualitative assessment that still sort of minimizes or undervalues its contribution. So, you know, the long and short of it is this is big time. It also, what I didn't dwell on is the carbon reductions, which are very substantial. So another message out of this is, and I didn't do an evaluation on the carbon reduction. So this model is very limited, because it's not looking at other things that would have value. But it just points out that active transport at high levels is competitive with other strategies. I didn't dwell on the low carbon strategy, but that also has a huge, large potential to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But I don't think people realize that active transport is competitive with engineering solutions, electrification of the auto fleet as a mechanism for reducing greenhouse gases. So that's the basic presentation. And the idea is to build this module of cost benefit into the overall module so that transportation planners can just have this information as just part of the output when they do their transportation demand planning. Okay, thanks.
Great. Thanks to everyone. Lots of great ideas on this panel. So we have plenty of time for questions for anyone that you see up here. So, yes.
Okay. Yeah. The question is this movement of 4.4 minutes to 22 minutes a day, what does that actually mean? Okay, I'm going to get a little bit nerdy here, but when you look at travel behaviors, it is not a normal distribution. It is a log normal distribution. So how do you describe, and it's really spiky. I mean, there's a lot of people who do very little or nothing. I mean, like 60% of the population does very little or nothing, and then you have this long tail. So how do you describe this in some kind of meaningful way other than showing the actual distribution, which in some of my presentations I actually do? So what we tend to describe this is actually using the median. So these are actually medians of a population. So what this would really look like, and what the model does, it models the quintiles of the distribution. So we are creating a shift, and it's a log normal curve that we're sort of taking that that left hump and pushing it over a little bit to the right, and that's actually what's going on in the inner workings of the model. But just to describe it to people so that they have some way of understanding it, what we're using is just the median. So when you have really distorted distributions like that, averages tend to overstate things because you have that group of, I call them, I don't know what they're called, people in the Tyvek suit, not Tyvek suit, but the people who are high performance athletes who get on their bicycles and go miles, and that drags up the average in a way that makes it less representative. So we use that. If you want more details, I can give you more details. Hopefully that answers what that represents. No, but this is based on rates. So you can decipher the difference between the rate increasing and the actual numbers increasing because of increases in population. And the other thing that makes this kind of discussion confusing is the word mode share. This is there's trips and then there's distances. So you can look at either. I don't want to dwell on it because probably other people want to talk. But we could go offline after this session. I can hopefully make this clearer.
Two people who presented on Tuesday
Yeah. Actually, there's a fair body of literature on the proximity of public transit assets, rail, ferry, for example, in the very area that we did the study, and people's increasing use of physical activity. So in that sense, we actually, through modeling and actual survey data, can actually show that people who live closer to transit assets actually walk more or bicycle more. So we have some of those connections already, and there's recently been a meta-analysis done of a whole bunch of studies. Severo and Ewing did it, and they published in the APA journal, so I can get you some of that data. So there is evidence that people who live close to transit, for example, walk more. So, I mean, all the different permutations of that, biking, walking, and other kinds of things like, you know, trails, and that's there too. Sure. I think people hear the question. So, you know, what other aspects of the built environment were considered, especially in the safety arena? I shouldn't oversell what the model does and what it doesn't do. It basically is driven by the amount of walking and bicycling per person per day. And it actually doesn't address all the things that you would need to make changes in that level of biking and walking. And I'm working with people who are who've built land use planning models that show some of the relationships between the built environment, whether it's intersection density or mixed residential commercial use, and how travel behaviors are influenced by those things. So really, it's sort of a tandem modeling effort where other people will get into those kinds of issues of how safety infrastructure and other aspects of the built environment influence travel behavior, and that becomes input to the ITHIM model. So this model only does sort of one thing really well, which is once you know what the change in travel behaviors is, what's the health co-benefit now, what the monetary value is. But there's a lot of other back-end stuff that would, you know, the transportation demand models and other activities would be needed to say what the impact of those other things are.
Yeah, you know, you raise an interesting point, and I think on the slide it talked about, you know, the emerging issues, including the, you know, increase in the farmers' markets and the fairs and so forth. And I think for public health governance, you know, and what we try to do is provide, you know, resources and information for you as a community to be able to look at what's specifically happening. And I think part of, again, what we're saying is, as the governance entity, as the folks who are serving on these boards that link to the community, understanding what our community is, you know, what's happening in our community, and be able to bring that information back and to be able to really take a look at that. And again, depending on the state you live in, there are, you know, your authority is defined in statutes. And what's interesting too is I think with this, these whole concepts of changing with the food, what's happening with the foods, I think we're going to see more and more entities, governing entities and local health departments, you know, struggling with how do we address these issues. And a couple of resources that might be of help is the Public Health Law Network is doing, in fact, they helped with the raw milk webinar I know that we put on, and they're doing a lot of research in these areas too, and that just might be a resource to maybe connect with them on some of these specific issues and maybe look at maybe what your legal authorities might be and exactly what you're saying. Is it a good idea to just, you know, totally adopt a model, or is there some hybrid of a model that might work for you in your community? But it definitely to be able to reach out to other resources and seeing how it's being done in other communities. And my guess would be as these issues continue, we're going to see more and more information coming out about how to do that. And again, the beauty of what hopefully we're trying to do is provide those resources and those networking opportunities to see how other organizations are handling it. And I think if we can continue to share that information and find out what works, that ultimately there may be a new best practice, if you will, to address those issues. So it's a very good point, though. I think an issue that, you know, we're really going to face and continue to face in the future.
Okay, CDC's policy was policy, system, and environmental changes. Then CDC also came out and said we can't do anything with policy with the grant that we got. And then system changes sometimes are not very lasting. So in my thinking, I'm of course a newcomer to San Antonio. In my thinking, the built environment would definitely help people to be more active. It's one of the things that would motivate them. Whether everybody will do it, I don't know. But then at least there's something they say, okay, you can walk, there's a walking trail, there's a fitness station, go ahead and use it. They can't say, well, I don't have the money, or I don't have this. So there is some kind of motivation for them to do that. And of course, some cities are very pretty, and some cities are not. And San Antonio is, with the population that we have, the city is not, we have very funny streets. Streets will stop, and the name will start somewhere else. So the story is that a blind Mexican who did not know English named all the streets. So they're really, really crooked. So we just have too many challenges there. So we have to at least get the streets, you know, walkable, more sidewalks, and then parks, we should have walking trails. So that way, I think we have been able to do a lot in the city, which we would have never been able to do. So I think it's a good movement in the right direction for San Antonio.
Okay. You know, the pathways to health are complicated. I mean, it's not just like one or two things that we're going to do. So, you know, when we conceptualize, you know, what is producing health, you know, neighborhood conditions and the built environment is part of that. But that's also linked to institutional relationships in the community. And in this country, we've articulated models that explicitly name, you know, structural racism and, you know, class relationships, you know, as being part of that whole chain of things. So, you know, I didn't read the Robert Wood Johnson thing and, you know, figure out, you know, how they attributed, what did it say, 10%? 10% is actually huge. I mean, I don't think that's trivial. I mean, the Galea article that came out in American Journal of Public Health 2 years ago, looking at, you know, the social determinants of health, just the way McGinnis did look at the specific causes of health, looking at individual risk factors, whether, you know, alcohol and sedentary lifestyle and all that stuff. You know, poverty, education, segregation, and social support, you know, that accounted for about as much as those specific individual risk factors. And those accounted for about 50% of the premature mortality in the United States. So, I mean, you can operate at different levels. So, you know, the strengthening communities, you know, can address some of those issues, and they interact with one another in complex ways. So, just because it says 10%, I mean, there may be indirect effects that are multiplying through the system that, again, when you tease the string of the causality, you're not just hitting on the built environment, you're potentially hitting on all these other things, too. So, I don't know what kind of hierarchical modeling they did to come up with the 10%, but even 10% is a lot. That's a lot in a complex social system, so I wouldn't minimize it.
I would like to add, too, that when I started my career, I was doing a community health assessment, again, for my local community, and, you know, one of the things that I think is really important is, you know, as a local community, as, you know, the health agency and those, again, from the governance aspect working in there, I think it's really important to assess what the needs of your community are, really bring in the community stakeholders, because, you know, it varies. Like he said, it's very complex. It depends on what's happening in your community. But really look at the priorities and look at what the community is willing to do. And if you bring in the right stakeholders, you can say, okay, we've identified, you know, these as our top issues. And then you can go back and look at the various resources that are out there, which was, when I did it, one of the things I say now is that with the internet, I mean, we're just on the verge of the internet when this was happening. I didn't, you know, wasn't as advanced as it is today. The CDC has a community guide, which has literally evidence-based practices on how to address certain issues. We didn't have access to that. But to be able to look at those resources that are out there and then find what works for your community, what you think is going to work, and just start, you know, taking those issues and figuring out how you can put those things into place. And whether it's build environment, if that's something that's going to work for your community and you get the community behind it and to support it and then willing to participate in it, you know, I say go for it, whatever, you know, whatever's working. But also, as the flip side of that, once you evaluate that, you know, it's always important to just keep monitoring and seeing if it's really making a difference. And I think what we're looking for in public health, and I know that this is something Nabla talks to CDC about a lot, is, you know, what are those success stories? What are the things that are happening at the local level? Because, you know, the reality is this is where public health is at the local level. This is where the rubber meets the road. And are there examples of successes? And sharing those successes and let other communities be able to see what's working and then be able to look at it from what will work in their community.
Thank you all so much for coming. Let's give our panel another round.